The Soviet Union is a powerful nation. I mean, let's militarily, very powerful. Economically, they've got a lot of problems. Socially, they have a lot of problems. But they are a very strong military power. There is absolutely, you know, I don't think the debate, very few people in the debate will, I can't think of any, claim that they're not. They'll disagree over why they have all this military power. Helen Caldicott says, well, they're the only nation in the world surrounded by hostile communist nations. So they have a justifiable paranoia, if that's possible. In fact, their friendliest border is to the north, which is the North Pole, and we're on the other side of it. So, I mean, and you stop to think of it, there's some reality there. They point out their history, that they've been invaded so many times. And they also point out that they're really not a nation as so much an empire, that the Russians are becoming a minority in the Soviet Union. So that is one response that you do get. However, in terms of the military that they do have an enormous quantity. And why they have that is subject to debate. I think most people agree that part of it is just the inertia of the system itself, that once you start certain programs, it's hard to stop them. They have some of the same problems we have. They're very sensitive about being behind technologically. They're very sensitive about that. Their history, they were always kind of looked on as kind of the unsophisticated area of Europe. And maybe not even included. So they have some, from what I can gather, some insecurity, an insecurity complex in terms of their technological capabilities. And so when the Star Wars program comes up, has all this fantastic high technology, they get nervous because they're afraid they might be left behind. That's why when they set up the first satellite, this was really something fantastic for them. However, they are technologically behind. That's the fact. So if you look at all the numbers there, you have to watch out in terms of how you interpret them. For example, they have much larger warheads. If you take the total amount of the power of the weapons that they can deliver this way and we can deliver that way, they have more. That's the megatonnage, or the throw weight of their missiles. Part of the reason for that is they had to build very large missiles because they did not have the computer technology and the sophisticated technology to make them small. It's a more difficult job, technical job, to make them small. Most of theirs are liquid-fueled rockets, which fueling is a difficult problem because they couldn't develop, at least until fairly recently, the solid fuel that we have. We have solid fuel rockets that it's easier to store them than all the rest of that. So when you're comparing them, you have to keep that in mind. You have to keep that in mind. So I would watch out on the comparisons. In terms of people who study both systems, I haven't met any Americans who would like to trade. So in terms of trading their system for our system, that's not there. So whether they're ahead or behind, that's debatable. The other part is, what does it mean to be ahead? I'm not sure. What the purpose in terms of having more rockets? I mean, if you don't need more, why have more? So the basic question is it a crazy kind of race? You know, we each have 25,000 nuclear warheads, about 10,000 each strategic nuclear warheads. Does it really make any difference if one side has 8,000, the other side has 12,000? I mean, with all that power, what can you do with it? Okay. So, you know, the whole argument, are they ahead or are they not ahead, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, at least to me. Now, obviously, if they had huge amounts and we had next to nothing, then, you know, you begin to say, well, how come they got all that, and what are they intending to do with it? You know, you would raise that kind of question. But that's not what's happening now. Some people are raising the question, though. In the 1970s, they increased the amount that they had tremendously. Why? Is that a reflection of their intentions or what? So there's been a big debate about that. We could go into that if you'd like to. Hawks and doves have different answers on that, obviously. Okay, so from that perspective, it's very difficult to really make these comparisons. And I think you can waste a lot of time counting up all the little pieces and saying who's got more and who's ahead, as though this was a baseball game or comparing points. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. The second part that was raised was on the treaty violations. We do have some treaties with the Soviet Union. And when you want to find out how many violations they have, of course, it depends who you ask. If you ask someone who really has a ideological resistance or objection to the Soviet Union, very passionately against the Soviet Union, of course, they will list a whole lot of violations that they think they have, whereas if you have someone else who's more sympathetic to the Soviet Union, their list is much shorter. So how do we make a decision? Because I don't know. I can't go over there, and I don't understand the treaties. And so what I've done is I've read several of them and kind of lined them up to see where they agree and where they disagree. In terms of just massive violations, blatant violations, I haven't seen that. There are a number of violations, and most of them involve interpretations of what the treaties really say, because both sides seem to be nibbling away at the edges of the treaty, see how much you can get away with. There do appear to be several, by several I mean three or four, that are major unresolved conflicts right now. But in terms of the Soviet Union totally disregarding the treaties, I don't think the evidence, as I read it, would support that. That they might cut some corners? Well, yeah. However, if you look at the Star Wars program we're proposing, they are claiming that we're cutting corners on the anti-ballistic ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile, because we have a treaty.
Is that all they're claiming? I
mean, no, they're
claiming that that's a major violation, right. Totally out of proportion to anything else that's on the books.
Well, they're claiming that. However, there are certain testing of components that you're allowed under that treaty. So when are you testing a component and when are you testing a system? See, they say you can test certain parts of the system, but you can't test the whole system. Well, how do you define a system and how do you define a part? It's like you're not allowed to test an automobile, but you can test the engine, you can test the transmission. Well, how much of the automobile, if I leave the headlights off, does that mean it's just a component or is it really an automobile? You see what I mean? The interpretations get to be very, very difficult. Yes?
Back to the treaties. I'm not clear. Treaties have been proposed, but I haven't heard that treaties have been signed by the United States.
Oh, yes.
The United States have not signed. Right. And yet again, they're looked at as being
SALT II treaty.
The Soviets should be bound by it, but not us. And well, it seems to me that what I'm hearing is that our country is saying, well, we've made the treaty, we've made up this set of rules and regulations, but we're not going to sign it, but we expect you to abide by it.
Well, I don't think it quite goes that way. You're right that there are some treaties that we had hoped to sign, but due to the disagreement, mainly the war, the Afghanistan invasion, the United States chose not to, and the political climate changed in the United States, and the United States chose not to sign what is known as the SALT II Treaty. And in particular, President Reagan and the group that surrounded him opposed the SALT II Treaty, so that was part of the political history. So right now, the SALT II treaty is not signed. We do have a number of other treaties that have been signed. We don't test nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. Neither one of us do. We only test certain size nuclear weapons underground. There's a limit. Now, of course, how do you test? That becomes a problem. Not a very big problem. They seem to be able to have that one down. We are, certain areas, the United States and the Soviet Union, from what I understand, are very much in agreement. Non-proliferation, not allowing a whole lot of other countries to get nuclear weapons. We're in agreement on that. And the Soviets had probably done as much as anyone, from what I know. I'm giving you secondhand information. People tell me that they take that very seriously. Now, on the SALT II treaty, this put certain limits on the number of rockets you can have, the launchers you can have, and they've argued, President Reagan's political group and President Reagan, when that treaty was being negotiated, they argued against it because they felt it was giving too much to the Soviet Union. Now, other people disagree with that. Okay, I don't know enough about the treaty to really tell. However, one of the things that's happened now that President Reagan is in office over the years is that the Soviet Union is pushing up against the limits of that treaty. It's an unsigned treaty, but unofficially we're both abiding by it. They're pushing up against the limits more than we are. Okay? Moreover, if we remove those limits, they can expand much faster than we can. So it's to our advantage now to say, hey, let's not exceed the limits of the SALT II treaty. You see? Mm-hmm. However, you can see the position that President Reagan is in. Okay, and his military people tell him that. Hey, if we remove those limits, they're going to be able to expand much more rapidly than we are. Okay, that's
expand,
what he tells them.
Expand what?
The number of launchers, rockets, warheads, the whole nuclear weapons.
Which is fairly meaningless, though, you said.
Well, I mean, I think we would agree that having 10,000 nuclear weapons, and they have 12,000, you know, that's not going to make a whole lot of difference, but if they double the numbers that they have, that makes us a little uneasy, okay? If you've got more things, even if they don't intend on using them, you've got more things that might go wrong, okay? So I think everybody is saying, let's try, or most people are saying, let's try to at least put a lid on the numbers of these, and let's try to design them so that they're safer. And I'll go into that, how you can have a bad missile and a good missile. Well, there are differences. There are differences. And I'll explain. There really are differences, particularly in a time of tension, international tension. There's some of the weapon systems that could set the thing off much easier than others. And so they're trying to get away from, quote, the bad missiles. I mean, you say, you know, once they're fired, you're dead. You're dead. That's true. But there's some that are more likely to be fired than others. Okay, I'll explain that a little later. So in the Soviet Union, our military are saying, hey, wait a minute, we better not, you know, throw out the SALT II limitations. Well, that puts President Reagan in this bind because all of his political supporters campaigned against it. And yet, as commander-in-chief, he looks out there and he says, it would be to our disadvantage to get rid of it. So he's in a political hard spot right now. So far, he has stuck with the SALT II. I got to give him credit for that. He stuck with the SALT II limitations. And so we'll see what happens. So there are treaties. Now, when you're negotiating a treaty, and I just got back from a workshop where I talked with people who were really in this, because I've never been involved in it. The real negotiations are not in Geneva between the two sides. They make some proposals, and they have very little slack in what they say. Then they have to go back and negotiate within their own governments. And you have all these bureaucratic pressures, you have all these internal politics within the Soviet Union and within the United States. That's where the real negotiations occur. They had, one example is Paul Nitze. He went out, he was getting so frustrated, and the Soviet Union negotiator was getting frustrated, so they went for a walk in the woods. This is the famous walk in the woods proposal. And they said, look, let's cut through all this. Suppose your side does this and our side does this. Okay? And I can't tell you the details of it. But it sounded like pretty good. It's just like if you and I went out and said, hey, wait a minute. We can't get a perfect world, but certainly we can do something to improve this craziness. Just like we would say that, right? That's what they did. Okay? And they came up with this proposal. Sounds pretty good. They sent it back. And it couldn't get through the bureaucracies of the both sides. And in particular, in the United States bureaucracy, it couldn't get through. Now, Paul Nitze was a hawk. I mean, it wasn't that he was coming from the pacifist tradition by any means. I mean, he's part of the President Reagan's team, I mean, and has been. So the negotiation quite often goes on internally, and they have to sense the political climate. And so it does matter, I think, what the citizens in the United States are saying, because then our system adapts, and it might adapt to allow something a little bit better in the Geneva discussions. You see what I mean? So that's how some of the negotiations go. Let me go over that issue of how some missiles are better than other missiles. Okay? We'll take the MX missile right now. This is an ICBM. That means it goes from the United States to the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union has similar missiles. So, I'm not picking on ours. They have similar missiles of similar characteristics, not as technologically sophisticated. Most of theirs aren't as sophisticated. MX is a missile. It can be fired within seconds, very quickly. I don't have to tune it up and fuel it and all the rest of it. And it has 10 warheads on it, very accurate. 10 warheads on it, very accurate. Now, that to me is a bad missile. Why? Let's think about that. 10 accurate warheads, that means, let's suppose we were to fire that one missile, and we were to put 2 warheads on each one of their missiles. Okay, 2 warheads on each one of theirs. We could fire one of our missiles, and if we had 2 warheads, just to make sure, we could knock out 5 of their missiles. You see? 5 of their missiles. 5-to-1 trade-off. Not a bad deal. Okay? They see that, and they say, uh-oh. There's a missile. One missile can knock out 5 of ours. Bad for us. But we have a missile on here with 10 warheads. Okay. One of our missiles could knock out 5 theirs. Good deal. But it's only a good deal if you go first. You see? You get the idea. If you wait, you get the bad deal. You see what I mean? So in a time of crisis, what happens is, when people start panicking and they start thinking that way, because most people normally, even the Soviet Union and the United States, they don't sit around and say, boy, we can trade off one of our missiles for 5 of theirs. I mean, they don't think about that way. I think most of them believe that nuclear war is a horrible kind of thing. I mean, they do. Soviet Union lost 20 million people. I believe President Reagan when he says, it's a horrible, horrible thing. But nevertheless, in a panic, in a state of crisis, where you're starting to think, hey, they might go first, you may start thinking that way. You get the idea. In a state of panic, you might say, hey, they are getting ready to fire at me because they're going to have 5-to-1 odds. I have no choice. See, in a state of panic, they might start thinking this way. My only choice is, do I fire first or second? You get the idea. It's not, do we have a war, do we not have a war? They begin thinking differently in their mind. The only thing is, do I fire first or second? Well, if you fire first, you get 5-to-1 odds. And if they fire first, they get 5-to-1 odds. The answer is obvious. Fire first, if that's the way you're thinking. Okay? Well, a war could start that way. I mean, nobody could be really wanting to start it. But both sides think the other one's going to, and then all of a sudden one gets a little itchy, and the whole thing goes. So the MX, in that sense, with 10 warheads, accurate warheads, okay, is a problem. Okay. Now,
can I suggest that there's one good part to that missile in what you said, and maybe it's bad for some other reason, but the ability to fire it quickly does give you the ability to not go first. If it's quickly enough that it could be a response.
Only if you're willing to, we talked about this, tune up your system. That is, have the system with everybody with their fingers right on the triggers. And I'm using that metaphorically because obviously it's a huge system and we have to rely on the computers and a tremendous amount. See, it takes only 30 minutes for the missile to get from the Soviet Union to the United States or vice versa. And if it's fired from a submarine, it might take only 15 minutes. Okay? So that means if we're going to fire our missiles while their warheads are in flight, we have to be all ready to go. And we have to believe the data coming in from our satellites. And we have to eliminate the people from the decision because they take too long, transfer it to the computers. And then our discussion of the computers, a lot of times computer systems kind of maybe don't work right. Well, you have to go ahead, and if it's not working right, you just presume that they're coming in. Okay, you have to make it in a state of crisis. That's a dangerous situation. We might have both sides say, hey, I'm going to get ready to launch mine in 15 minutes, within, say, 15 minutes. So if they launch theirs, I'll launch mine. Well, they're both there. There's liable to be a mistake, a misperception. They all start going, and no one really decided. So you see that we get a problem there. So there's two kinds of problems, you see. Now, there's another missile that they're proposing, which they claim is a better missile. Now, by better, I mean it more as the lesser of the evils, okay? Because, I mean, obviously, anytime you have a weapon that can destroy and kill people, that's a bad thing to have, okay? However, it may be the lesser of two evils. There's a good book on the so-called just war theory. It's by John Howard Yoder. He's making a challenge to the just war theory. And he's a pacifist. So it's a I just started reading it up at home. Good book. I'll talk about that later. What they decided on the Midget Man missile is a small missile with only one warhead. One warhead. Okay? Now let's suppose both sides only had one. Okay? Now if I fire my one over there, well, of course it might not work. Remember I said you fire two warheads at each missile? Okay? That's what you do. That means I have to fire two rockets in order to get two warheads, just to make sure I get it. Okay, I have to fire two of them. Okay, they got an advantage then. I fired two of mine to get rid of one of theirs. Doesn't make much sense. Doesn't make any sense to do that. Right? Doesn't make any sense. And they're in the same position. They have to fire two of theirs to get one of ours. And in a state of crisis, the Soviets are sitting there saying, are they going to fire theirs at us? I said, well, gee, if they fire two of theirs to get one of ours, that doesn't make any sense. We might as well wait. If they want to fire two of theirs to get one of ours, we may end up, after they fire, having more left over than they do. Then we'll be able to dictate the terms. Okay, you see? So you see, you've got a missile there that the Midget Man missile, which is considered a better, a more stabilizing, what they usually call a weapon. Okay, so all weapons are not equally bad. That's what they're claiming. Now, the pacifist tradition quite often will say all weapons are equally bad. And I don't know. I'm not sure. I'd like to see how they would address that. The just war theory people do not say that. They're different degrees of evil, and that you have to select the lesser of the evils. Yes?
David, what do you think is the best way to prevent the nuclear war? Do you think it's deterrence, or do you think it's unilateral disarmament, or do you think it's negotiations, or specifically, what do you think?
Well, in terms of an ultimate answer, in terms of if I were a dictator of the world, I'm not really sure how I'd unravel the Gordian knot we've got right here. But I do have some suggestions, and we were talking about that last night, of what I would do now to make the system less bad. Let's put it that way. Obviously, if we could live in a world where there was peace, there was mutual trust, this is the world we should be working for. How do we get from here to there is a real serious problem. Right now, what I have proposed, and I have a paper where I did this, is I took this Midget Man missile, remember the one with the one nuclear warhead, and they plan to have it mobile. One of the reasons they have it mobile is so that the Soviet Union would, even if they, there's just no possible way that they could knock out these missiles, okay? Because it's very hard on a mobile system. And I'm more convinced of that after the last couple of weeks on a workshop. The satellites being, the reconnaissance satellites, they have to do some amazing things, but they can't track cars or truck as it drives around. That technology just isn't there now. So what I propose is, let's not have the MX missile. And I've got that in a paper. By the way, I feel, well, this reflects our discussion, I feel if I'm going to study it, every now and then I need to come out and say, what would I do? I can't just take pot shots at other people, okay? And I feel that I should write it down, put my name on it, because when you write something down, it requires a lot more discipline when you put your name on it. And I ought to write it in a way and publish it in a place where the people who are going to read it are not, you know, they're not people who already think like I do. It's nice and easy for me to come to Holman and go ahead and say, I believe in peace, or I believe, I mean, we all agree with that. But if you're going into people who are designing nuclear weapons and you come out and you start saying that, they're going to look at you rather strange. So you don't want to just preach to the safe. You've got to try to do something with a group of people who might disagree with you. So I wrote this one paper, and I have a copy of it, that if we tilt the midget man, remember, that's the small one, and what we ought to do is we ought to deploy it without the warheads. Without the warheads. Deploy them separately. Have what I call a resilient system, and build in a lag time into the system, and I'd say at least 24 hours. Now, I go through the rationale on that. And what I try to do is I try to explain on other people's assumptions, okay, traditional deterrence, for example, that this will still provide traditional deterrence, but it will do some other things. It will do some other things.
Could you back up for a second and tell me, you say without a warhead?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Well, you deploy the warhead separately from the, you know, from the missile. I make the argument that the worst place to store a warhead is on the end of a missile. Okay? The idea being, in traditional deterrence, that, you know, they're mobile, you can move them around, but there's no way that, I mean, if they want to, it would be crazy for them to fire, you know, their missiles to try to knock these things out. It would be essentially impossible. But they still face the risk that if they ever did have a nuclear attack, we'd put the warheads on and fire them back. And so that there's still the traditional deterrence. There's still the traditional deterrence. But what we've done is we've built in a lag time in our system, a deliberate lag time, and I would say at least 24 hours. Now, I saw a videotape of the people who were involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they came out and they said it was lucky that they waited 24 hours. Because during those first several hours, within that first 24 hours, they came by with all kinds of crazy solutions. They switched back and forth, and they, one minute they were ready to bomb them all, and then the next time they changed their mind, and it took them about 24 hours to kind of settle down. And all of them were saying, boy, we need that time. Well, if that's the case, I'm speaking more as an engineer, then you've got to build the system. It can't respond in less than 24 hours. Because if you've got a system that can respond in 2 minutes, and the leaders themselves are saying, gee, we can't really make good decisions in 2 minutes, then why have a system that can respond in 2 minutes? Okay. Plus that, this system, you know, without the warrants, is less threatening to the Soviet Union. Okay. So if it's less threatening to the Soviet Union, it's going to be harder for their hawks to say, they're getting ready to attack you. So what do you mean? They don't even have armed missiles. They haven't even armed them. Okay? That's crazy. Okay, so this is a very brief, I'll leave copies of the paper so you can read it. Yeah.
Where does the Polaris fit into all of this? Because you're talking about ICBMs, but...
I really haven't gotten into the Polaris was the first submarine launch missile system. They're phased out pretty much now.
Right.
Right now it's the Trident, and I haven't spent as much time studying those, but they pose a certain danger. Now, one of the advantages people are claiming for the submarine launch missiles is you can wait. You don't have to go ahead and fire very quickly. It's the land-based missiles that you have to fire quickly. That, I don't know enough about the technology. That may be changing, though, without us really recognizing it. Because what they're doing, they're trying, from what I understand, I'm giving you sketchy information here, just that I've heard talking with people, that they are developing a new warhead for the Trident called the D5, which has, I don't know, 10 to 14 warheads on it. I think, you know, so I mean, a Trident missile has something like 240 warheads. I mean, these are hydrogen bombs, 241. It's a frightening weapon system. But the thing that bothers me is they've got this D5 missile, which is a very accurate warheads. But it depends upon a satellite, okay, a satellite for its guidance. Now, you start to think, how, at first that doesn't sound too bad. But you have to start to think of how will people respond in a crisis? Well, seems to me, if I was in the military, I would think if the Soviet Union was going to attack us, what would be one of the first things that they would attack?
The satellites.
That means, if you are thinking that way, you're going to start saying, if we're going to use those missiles, and they're for their design, based on their design, to be accurate, you better be prepared to use them quick before that satellite gets knocked down. See? You get the idea? So then what that does is that undermines the supposed advantage of the submarine, which means, hey, you don't have to have a hair trigger because there's no way they can knock out the submarines. So you can take your time, and I agree with that. We ought to take our time. But with this new warhead, they may not think that way. So I'm uncomfortable with the new D5. Now, I'm uncomfortable with all of it. What I'm trying to do is try, I don't know how to solve all the problems, but I'm trying to get at what I think are the worst things and try and do something better. Yeah.
To what extent do you think that our decisions are being based on a need to provide jobs for and are being enamored with technology. This whole conversation begins to sound like a wonderful experiment to be in.
You're absolutely right. I think that's one of the major driving efforts, if not the major one. Now, again, I'm not saying that means, therefore, the Soviet Union is harmless and all of this is totally ridiculous. I'm not prepared to go that far, okay? But I would say that the drive to produce this gee whiz technology is there. It's a very seductive kind of thing. It is at the cutting edge of technology. It's fascinating, and it's lucrative. Although I think the fascination probably accounts more for the drive. You may want to ask.
I was going to ask what you thought on the Russian side. They don't have the lucrative thing so much.
Oh, I think they do.
They do, but it's more a power one than a monetary one. But do they have that same fascination with the technology,
I think they have a fascination, but probably even an insecurity. They're trying to prove that they're just as good. It's kind of a macho game.
So that's
going to
make it go more than...
So that'll make drive theirs. And also, I think even in a socialist system or a governmental bureaucracy, you are competing for funds. Okay? I mean, most of the stuff we do isn't free market system, you know? It's run through the government systems, and you're competing for funds. And you know, any of you who work for agencies, when it comes down to competing for funds, boy, they make the best possible case they can. I mean, including different divisions in churches and everything else. But what happens is this does create an inertia. And once you get a large, powerful organization, it becomes extremely difficult to go ahead and head it off. And you are absolutely right. It is a fascinating kind of thing to work in for the people in it. So I think this is a major, major problem. Maybe the major problem. Absolutely right. And I alternate. I have to admit myself, sometimes I get in it and it just sounds fascinating. Then other times I get extremely depressed and I have to leave it aside because you know, you start having bad dreams about this stuff. So there's this tremendous emotional dimension to it. And it turns out that the technical and scientific mentality for working with that tends to deny that emotional attachment. Yeah.
Dave, what do you think would happen if you expanded your plan? You made this proposal about the midget men. If this afternoon the United States took every warhead we had off the top of the rocket and put it over in a, you know, a truck or a, some mobile thing or a silo, a separate storage. So we had all of the warheads that we had this morning, but
we didn't have any of the weapons.
No weapons. And okay. We automatically,
you'd have the pieces there, but they don't know weapons.
We'd automatically have a 24-hour delay. What do you think would happen if we had that unilateral kind of disarmament right this afternoon? What do you think could happen tomorrow?
I don't think anything would in terms of the Soviet Union.
Well, it would have some impact on.
Well, I mean, in terms of, I don't think they attack us. I don't think they behave more hostily. I think they might get worried because they need an enemy.
Certainly, people would say, I wonder what they're doing.
we would have to watch it. Because, you see, we would have to watch it, though, because they might get paranoid and because it's so unusual.
They might think of something.
They might think that this is some secret plot to really do them in. So we got to realize, you see, that they you got a system there that needs an outside enemy to justify itself. Okay, you see, and ours does too. That's the only, so you'd have to. But I'm saying, if we could do that without creating.
What if you try to negotiate something like that?
Well, that gets very, you know, gets very difficult. But let me stick with his, and then we'll come to yours. I mean, if we could do that without creating a paranoid response from them, I mean, it sounds absurd. You're disarming your weapons. How terrifying! but you got to realize that we're not dealing with individuals. We're dealing with a large organizational system that shapes perceptions. Okay, it shapes perceptions, and that organizational system really shapes perceptions for internal needs to get people to go along. With the system. Same way with ours, to provide loyalty and order and all the rest of that. Now, how they would respond to that, they might respond, they say, the removal of the threat, the legitimate threat, might produce a response to produce a more fabricated threat, maybe. But if we could get by that, I don't think much would change. I think this might be a good thing to try to do.
Much less incentive for them to spend all the money, say, to go beyond those limits.
Right.
I mean, obviously, because then they would be...
Right. But then what would happen...
Yeah, immediately.
Right. They'd be ahead in one sense, but what does it mean to be ahead? Because they can't use it. Because if they did use it, they say, well, if we use it, you think they're going to leave them off the missiles? Now, maybe we would, okay? But then again, maybe we wouldn't. See, they don't know. I mean, so you'd still have the traditional deterrence, but it wouldn't be as threatening.
Well, wouldn't.
Okay, let's stick on this issue, and then we'll go to the negotiation. But let's just stick on how do you think they would respond? And then, so, yeah.
Well, the other response is that we have a lot of other weapon systems. I mean, we're only talking about one that's devastating, but there are many others that we have produced.
But the nuclear are so much an order of magnitude high.
We have an insidious system of gases that, that is not, we don't even want to talk them or think about that.
Okay, now, but the response of the Soviet Union, and it would be a strange thing, one of the problems, I think, and I'm working on a paper on this, is that we tend to think of the Soviet Union as though it's a person, an irrational person, okay? But it's this complex system over there. And I think the system, and our military system too, you need the external enemy to justify your own existence. And whether they, if we became less of an external enemy, whether they would create one, I don't know. I don't know. But I'd like to try something carefully to do that. I would. To disarm. Yeah.
One aspect of this discussion, which we really haven't touched upon, is getting the nuclear arms technology to a third world country like Libya, where an irrational person like Gaddafi might become trigger happy in a tense situation.
Now, I think the Soviet Union and the United States are in agreement to prevent that. That part right there is one area that I find that they're in agreement on. And there's probably other areas.
How do you prevent that?
How do you prevent that? Actually, there are some ways that they've actually, restrictions done that. And we also have, if you look 10 years ago at the predictions of how many nations would have nuclear weapons, the number now is less than the number they predicted. So there has been less of a proliferation.
What about the ones that do have it, though?
The ones that do have it, well, you have basically the United States, Russia, China, Britain, France, and India, Pakistan, close, and Israel. They usually include Israel in that. They take, I had one person say, we'll take India and Israel and make them one full-time equivalent nuclear power.
South Africa.
Well, South Africa, they're in question. They might. There was a satellite that reported an explosion out there that some people thought was a test. So, now, we still have to have a delivery system. I think that the question we have to address, the Soviet Union and both, and this is one reason I'm for building this 24-hour lag, at least a 24-hour lag time into the system, is that the real danger, and they would probably get an atomic bomb rather than a hydrogen bomb, which is a horrible thing, but it's about 1,000 times less horrible than a hydrogen bomb. So, I mean, there's different degrees of horror that we have here. I think the real danger that we would have from, say, a Gaddafi is not the destruction from the weapon that they might set off, but we want to make sure it doesn't trigger off our responses. You see what I mean? So if they were to set off a nuclear device smuggled into a country, I mean, that would be a horrible consequence, and I'm sure something devastating would happen to Gaddafi. I don't think Gaddafi would be around much longer. And I think the Soviet Union and the United States would be in agreement. They almost got, well, at one time, there were people arguing that the United States and the Soviet Union should, behind the scenes, cooperate on eliminating the nuclear development program in China. They didn't, but then there was some discussion on that. So I think the real thing with these third world countries is to make sure that they don't escalate into the superpowers, because we're the ones with the huge arsenals. That's why I think building some sort of lag time, so if an explosion goes off somewhere in a time of crisis, we say, cool it, folks. Let's really find out what happened. Yeah. I got to get back to you in a second. Okay.
You know, that really made the point. I think the thing that's the scariest, what we really need to be afraid of is ourselves. I mean, because we're the ones with all the, I mean, just like you said, if Gaddafi had a bomb, what we have to worry about is ours going off. And that gets me back to, I was thinking a lot about this last night after your discussion last night, and it, you know, seems sort of funny to everyone, and would seem real funny to the Russians about taking all our warheads off for even just to move them out 24 hours. And, you know, Jesus always did things that seemed real funny to people. And God has too, you know, like,
right.
You know, having his warriors walk around the walls for 7 days. I mean, that's the way, I mean, you know, what? The dumbest, you know, okay, you guys now walk into the Red Sea. I mean, taking the warheads off is real reasonable, but we kind of chortle at it like, oh boy, that would be crazy, and boy, the Russians would be crazy.
We should paint flowers now, make it, you know, make our weapons turn into ours. Ours are better than yours. Maybe we can even make kind of a, you know, humor on it.
And I was thinking last night that, you know, if Jesus were here, and I think this is the kinds of things we should be thinking about here, if Jesus were here, it would be very simple to him. I mean, we wouldn't need to discuss all this. It was real clear to me. I mean, what, you know, if you ask Jesus, what should we do with our nuclear warheads? Everyone in this room knows exactly what he said.
Well, I mean,
you would take them apart.
But I think...
Right now.
What Jesus
tomorrow,
gave us...
Right now.
I think...
They can hurt people. They can kill people. Yeah. You can't have that sort of thing. They're dangerous. We're a danger. We're horribly dangerous with that. You take them apart.
I think the main thing that Christ gives us is the courage and the spirit for us to struggle with, rather than Christ giving us this prescription. You know, this might be something, you know, the people in theology could expand upon. And I think that's what I mean, the power and the spirit to struggle with it. I mean the power and the spirit to keep going on it, even though the problem doesn't go away, even though we don't have obvious answers, even though we disagree, even though it's a messy world, we have the power and the spirit to continue on that with hope, even though the hope may not even be rational. And to me, that's the gift of grace. That's the message. And we can go out and do it, and even though it's painful, that's the theology of the cross. So I think that's really the kind of message. I have a hard time thinking, well, if Jesus were here, could I ask him and he'd give all the answers and then everything would be okay? That part I have a hard time. I don't know.
He would ask another question.
He would probably ask another question, and he would probably do that. Because I don't see him giving prescriptions, for example, on the Roman armies of the day that were there. I mean, it was a military-industrial complex, a global one at that time, too. So I think, you know, we are empowered to struggle with this. Now, let me get back over here, because you said a negotiated settlement with the Soviets on that.
Both of us have the part that has the lead time that we would both fill in.
I would like to have that. However, I had on this paper, I had a friend send it to Paul Warnke, who was the arms control negotiator under the Carter administration. He wrote back, he said, well, he didn't like the proposal I had there because he thought that we ought to negotiate with the Soviet Union, and I was proposing it unilaterally. Well, if they would do it, I would like that. I'm afraid the negotiation process takes so long. I think we need to do something on a unilateral initiative. And if we can negotiate it, okay, but I'd hate to make that a requirement. If we have a system that's dangerous, okay, and it's bad for us, I'd like to go ahead and, you know, eliminate it through negotiations so they eliminate theirs also.
What would be the advantage? Would it be an advantage to propose it and give them some lead time to think about it and say, this is in our thoughts and so forth, and if we can't negotiate it, we're going to do this ourselves, so they would. This wouldn't be just sprung on them without...
That might be. I think
that would pose a terrible problem in their bureaucracy. Not only do they propose that we do it and we can't figure out why, but then they're going to do it anyway if we don't.
Well, I think the hardest negotiation would be within our own system. The hardest negotiation, and their hardest would be within their system.
There would be people who would be told to figure out why they're doing this. And what are all the possibilities? And those people would struggle to find something crazy in it. And if they failed, they would have failed, and they would try harder, and they would never approve until they would only approve if they could show that it was wrong, and they could oppose it. But they could never say, well, I can't see anything wrong with it,
that's
so
right.
Go ahead.
And if a person did say that, they would kind of find themselves out of the system.
Exactly.
See, that's the difference between the system and the person. You may have some individual people that say, gee, that sounds like a good idea. But the system tends to adapt, not through a plot, but just the way organizational systems are, to make their voice less heard. Okay? So anyhow, I think we should try it. But I would propose right now that we try, I would rather go unilaterally than not go at all. Let's put it that way. And I think that the idea is crazy. You're right, I think. But that's the purpose, you see, of a citizenry. In the Soviet Union, you have a more totalitarian state in the sense that they're not able to go ahead and raise as many questions as we do and publish them and so forth and so on. And however, if we're a culture where we don't raise the issues, these crazy issues, then in a sense, our democracy behaves as though it was a totalitarian state. You see, the difference between a culture where you're not allowed to do it and where you are allowed to do it, but you don't do it anyhow, there isn't a whole lot of difference as far as I can see. Yeah.
I'd like to pull a few things together. First of all, I'd like to combine those things. That is, for us to take a unilateral step and tie that in with negotiation, invite the Soviet Union to participate or to respond in some way. And we have a precedence for that working. The Limited Test Ban Treaty was established because the United States unilaterally said, and that was because we were afraid of the strontium 90 at the time, but we said unilaterally, we are not going to test in the atmosphere. And we invite the Soviet Union to respond. Now, somewhere in that process, the Soviet Union did give one test in the atmosphere, but we exercised restraint. But since that time, in 1962, there has not been a test by the U.S. or Soviet Union in the atmosphere, and the Limited Test Ban Treaty came out of that. So you can take unilateral steps that I would be opposed to just doing it. I think you do it and invite the Soviet Union to do something reciprocal so that you move toward an unwinding. And the second point on that hasn't been mentioned in the discussion is, I agree with the fact that the Soviet Union is ambitious and it's paranoid and all those kinds of things, but there's another element in that there is an element of self-interest that's got to be the basis for negotiation or for a conclusion. And one important element of self-interest, especially with new leadership in the Soviet Union, is that they're interested in having more consumer goods and investing in their development. They have half the gross national product we do. That means for them to stay in the arms race with us, it takes twice as much of a percentage out of their slice as we do. They've got is that right?
More, really? Because yeah. Their system, because of the secrecy, is very inefficient.
Yeah, okay.
So,
there's communication and everything. So, but anyhow, the point is that they have, that's a powerful reason for them in their own self-interest to negotiate and to reduce arms reduction. I mean, you don't have to talk about something being nice and cuddly and all. I mean, just for their own self-interest, the well-being of their, there's a powerful interest for them to negotiate and to establish something at a lower level. And the third thing I want to mention is, this business about being, what we're doing here, I think, is terribly important because this is a democracy. The Limited Test Ban Treaty got put in place because of citizen action that insisted that we didn't want to explode weapons in the atmosphere. It didn't come out of a defense, the experts, exactly. It came because the citizens insisted. And I visited with people who were involved in that negotiation and said, we go and play our little games in negotiations, but when the U.S. Says, now we got to be serious about that when it comes to the citizens, then you get some action. That's why our discussions are very important, and they've had results in that, but also in, let's say, the deploying of the MX. It was citizen action that it's only because of citizen action that the MX, that we're not involved in the biggest building project in history of basing the MX in Utah.
So we had 200 missiles then. Now it's down to 40, I think. It'll go less than, maybe it'll never get to 200. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's because of citizen action. I mean, we shouldn't talk about our powerlessness. That is, things have happened already in this that citizens have affected.
Yeah. One of the best descriptions of exactly what you say comes from Dwight Eisenhower. In his farewell address, he made several warnings. But the most famous was the warning of the military-industrial complex. Okay, and he also warns about the experts. And I think the two of those go close together. And when they asked him, well, what do you do about that? He says, only an alert and informed citizenry. That was his response. Now, a lot of people say, oh, Eisenhower, he's a nice guy. Some speech writer wrote that. They're finding out, no, that was not the case. Eisenhower is now, as the revisionist historians are finding out, that Eisenhower was a very remarkable person. I talked to Herbert York a couple weeks ago, who actually talked to Eisenhower on this. And he said those two things really were the most important things he wanted in his farewell address. He says, then fill in with the other stuff. The other thing, I'll get to you in a minute. The other thing in his warning, and I've got some quotes on this, you want to, he warns about what can happen to the universities. Now, they haven't picked up on this warning. But he has their warning on the military-industrial complex, warning on the experts, and warning on what happens to the universities, that universities will cease to be a place of free inquiry, and they will instead, the faculty will be dominated by the pursuit of dollars and grants. And if you look at what's going on in the university, boy, he has described it exactly. And I've got a paper on that if you want to look. Okay, now I'll get to you.
Well, I just, you know, in commenting on what Herman said, and it's just, it isn't our ideas or your proposal or anything like that that's the least bit crazy. I mean, the crazy
thing
is what we got.
And where we're going.
Our proposals are great, and they're only little steps. There's nothing crazy about them. They're great.
I got one other proposal, and I'd like to test out on it.
Now you encouraged him too much.
No, I got this. I'm working on a paper, so I'm working on a paper now. One of the proposals is this: one of the ways that we reinforce ideas and perceptions is through technology. If you have a hammer laying around, and somebody gives us all hammers, we all get the perception we're supposed to pound on something. No one has to tell us that. You see, if you've got the technology in hand, the tool in hand, okay? So you begin to reflect that. Now, in philosophy, Martin Heidegger was the one that, if you study philosophy, he stressed that what your practices are and your instruments are reflects what your understanding is and your perceptions. So if that's the case, then what we need to do, and maybe the church needs to take a role on this, is we need to develop technologies that reinforce the perception that the use of nuclear weapons is unbelievably immoral. Okay? We all agree that the use of nuclear weapons is immoral, and we preach it. But if I'm correct, even a little bit correct, that our perceptions, particularly in a time of crisis, is reflected in the procedures and the techniques and the equipment that surround us. We tend to conform to it. Then what we need to do is say, what kind of equipment, procedures, techniques, use of technology could we have that reinforces that perception? Okay, you get my idea. So here's my proposal I'd like to test out. We would have one of the problems in getting across a perception about the immorality of use of nuclear war is what we were talking about, is people tend to define responsibility not in terms of the global issues, but in terms of their job. Okay, that's the other problem. What we need to do is get a technology that reinforces the perception, all of us, not just the president, have a responsibility beyond just doing your job. How can we do that? One proposal I suggest is that we have, either through the United Nations or some other group, that we have a satellite monitoring archival system that will record whatever the events occur, if there was a nuclear war, for the archives of history. We could have the headquarters in Nuremberg, and the idea is that you're displaying with your technology, you're displaying and reflecting in the technology the notion of moral responsibility. We have mutually assured moral accountability, okay? And you're reflecting it in the technology itself. So give some thoughts to that. That's, another crazy idea that we might want to try out. Yeah?
And to what extent is it to our advantage to have the Soviet Union continue to find its intimacy
instead of
into production and all
of
those things? What extent is
that
helpful that they
don't
compete?
You mean compete militarily?
No. Economic.
Oh, economic. There are people in the Reagan administration that are arguing that the arms race is good for us because it draws money away. And what it does is it weakens their economy. Of course, it weakens ours too, but they say it weakens theirs more, and we can take it more than they can, and they're making that argument. However, let's suppose that the economic system of the Soviet Union starts collapsing. Is that a safer world for us? It just doesn't make much sense to me. They get desperate and history has too many examples of when internal crises occur, you want to look for an external enemy to blame it on. And so but there are people who are making that argument, and there's
people in a sort of a stagnant level.
Yeah, we hold them, or even worse, they're people making, we push them on this arms race thing to the point that their economy starts coming apart, and the Soviet Union will split up into several nations. That's what they're talking about.
It could be that Gorbachev now is probably one of the first leaders that can see through this economic dependence that they would have if they could steer away from going there and get into consumer goods. It'd be interesting to see how he's going to work.
That could be. It'd be very interesting to see, because he's a new generation of Soviet leaders. The old revolutionaries are dying out. He's a new generation.
Thank you.
Okay, sure.
You had some copies.